In this weekend's episode, three segments from this past week's Washington Journal. First, Zeev Sanderson of New York University's Center for Social Media and Politics discusses the use of artificial intelligence and the impact it could have on the 2024 election. Then, Hudson Institute's Michael Duran and Benjamin Friedman of Defense Priorities discuss the latest in the Israel-Hamas war, role of Iran's proxy forces, and concerns about a wider conflict in the Mideast. Plus, The Wall Street Journal's Richard Rubin discusses congressional efforts to pass a package of tax breaks that would impact businesses and parents.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Hi, this is Rachel from C-SPAN's podcast team.
And I'm Sean, a C-SPAN producer, and we'd like to tell you about Word for Word, our evening newsletter that I write each day.
If you follow politics and policy, we think you'll also like reading Word for Word.
Think of it as your evening briefing on Washington's most important stories delivered straight to your inbox. Find out what happened on Capitol Hill, the White House, and see video highlights.
Join our informed community. Subscribe to Word for Word today at cspan.org/connect.
Go deeper on the day's important stories. Subscribe now to Word for Word at cspan.org/connect. Thank you.
But next, a deep fake robocall during this past week's New Hampshire primary election is renewing fears about the role artificial intelligence could play in the upcoming campaign. We talked about it with Zeev Sanderson of NYU Center for Social Media and Politics.
So in talking about artificial intelligence deep fakes, can you first explain what that is?
Yeah, so pretty simply, a deep fake is the manipulation or fabrication of an image, audio recording, or video through automated means, with the intended effect of making something sort of appear to happen that didn't actually happen. And deepfakes have been discussed as potential threats in the last two major election cycles in 2020 and 2022. So I just want to quickly explain why this moment is different. We've long had technologies to manipulate sort of content in different mediums. Viewers at home know that Hollywood movies have been doing this for many, many years. But it's expensive and time-consuming. It took trained specialists with expensive software and required many, many hours. Now with AI, we have this different moment where the technology to create deepfakes has sort of been democratized, if you will. It's lowered the cost and increased the access.
Well, let's take a look. This was a fake robocall of what sounded like President Biden calling New Hampshire voters ahead of the primary, telling them not to vote. Take a look.
What a bunch of malarkey. We know the value of voting Democratic when our votes count. It's important that you save your vote for the November election. We'll need your help in electing Democrats up and down the ticket. Voting this Tuesday only enables the Republicans in their quest to elect Donald Trump again. Your vote makes a difference in November, not this Tuesday.
And again, that was not President Biden, although it sounded an awful lot like him. Your comment on that, Zeev, as far as being able to tell the difference?
It did sound a lot like him. If I had been on the other end of that phone call, I don't think I would have been able to tell the difference that it wasn't him. I think this is a challenging moment in the information environment. And I think what's sort of interesting that we've seen when it comes to deepfakes is actually a lot of the deepfakes that we've seen sort of break through have been audio only. They haven't been video or images. And I think that one of the reasons is because audio is very hard to fact check. You know, if someone wanted to create a fabricated video of Joe Biden, his every move is watched and recorded. It would be, there might be a few minutes or a few hours before it becomes fact checked, it is fact checkable. This is much harder. And I would say, it's a challenge moving into 2024 with that audio clip, for example, It would have been very easy to make using current technology. You can upload a few minutes of a politician's voice and then create an AI version of them saying whatever you want. So, you know, I think that you know, the public should go out with a healthy bit of skepticism, though I think I'll get back to this later. Not too much skepticism.
Well, Zeev, you did say that it was that this is being democratized, but how easy is it to do this now? I mean, could I do it? I mean, what kind of technical background do you need?
So, I mean, I think that you probably could do it, though, Mimi, I don't know what your technical background is. You know, I think that these technologies are very accessible. Depending on the different companies have different rules around what their technologies can be used for. So certain companies like OpenAI, for example, would expressly prohibit this type of content from being made using any of their products. But there are a number of products out there. Many of them are very, very good. And, you know, I'd say that they're not quite sort of as easy as just, you know, click and play, but they're getting there.
And another part of this, Zeev, would be what some people are calling the liar's dividend. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so the liar's dividend, what that refers to is that in an information environment where there's a lot of anxiety around sort of false or manipulated or fabricated content circulating, what it allows actors to do is claim that something that did happen, that actually did happen, that it didn't happen. And so you could imagine sort of in the context of 2016, the Access Hollywood tape coming out, which again is sort of an audio clip without video or a photo attached to it. And as we just saw with the Joe Biden clip, it's very easy to make this sort of audio content. You could imagine sort of Donald Trump having claimed that it was false. And so, you know, that is what the liar's dividend is. It'll give sort of strategic actors the general context in which to claim something that's true is actually false.
Well, let's take a look at a couple of other examples. This first one is an ad put out by the Republican National Committee just after President Biden announced his reelection campaign last year, and it features AI-generated fake images.
This just in, we can now call the 2024 presidential race for Joe Biden.
My fellow Americans.
This morning, an emboldened China invades Taiwan.
Financial markets are in free fall as 500 regional banks have shuttered their doors.
Border agents were overrun by a surge of 80,000 illegals yesterday evening.
Officials closed the city of San Francisco this morning, citing the escalating crime and fentanyl crisis.
Who's in charge here?
It feels like the train is coming off the tracks.
And Zeev, I mean, that's using AI-generated dystopian images of the future. Do you think that should be allowed?
Look, so they're both at the federal level and at the state level, you know, both lawmakers and regulators are considering what to do here. You know, I think I want to sort of point to some colleagues at UNC, Matt Peralt and Scott Brennan, and they argue that sort of two things. That first, public policy should target the electoral harms being done, not the technologies that are being used. Like I mentioned, it did sort of democratize access to these technologies, but really well-financed, you know, national campaigns would have had access to other sort of, you know, more nascent technologies in order to create fabricated images in previous years if they wanted to. So we should really focus on what the electoral harms that we're nervous about rather than the underlying technologies, given that at this point, you know, the sort of the cat is out of the bag. And the second is we're still sort of early days here. So a lot of policy, rather than sort of perhaps jumping the gun and focusing on the wrong thing, should really focus on promoting sort of learning or new knowledge about these, about how sort of generative AI might impact elections and especially political ads. And so there, you know, should be a big focus on transparency. So making sure that anytime, you know, generative AI is used, that it's that viewers at home would know it. But also promoting research to really understand what the effects of this sort of content is on voters.
But when you say transparency, I mean, if you've got some bad actors out there, they're not going to be transparent that they're using deepfakes.
Yeah, so they're not going to be transparent that they're using deepfakes. And so, you know, it might put some of the onus on, you know, the sort of mechanism by which it's reaching people, whether it's, you know, broadcast networks on, you know, on television, requiring them to do diligence in order to potentially apply labels, social media companies applying labels, or, you know, I mean, I know at the state level, they've been considering there being, you know, certain penalties for not disclosing.
You wrote a piece for Brookings, Zeev, that essentially says that AI can be misunderstood, and in some cases can be the fear of AI can be overhyped. Explain that.
Yeah, so I think a lot of our fear moving into 2024 is specifically around the sort of relationship between AI and misinformation. And so what we do is we start with a review of the academic literature on, you know, what do we know over the last 10 years about the ways that misinformation has or hasn't directly impacted elections. And by directly, I really mean sort of changed people's votes. And you know, we sort of make the argument reviewing this literature that actually we've been potentially too concerned about the impact of misinformation, that, you know, news doesn't really make up a majority of people's media consumption. And when it does, people tend to consume high quality media. And that misinformation, when it does exist, tends to be sort of heavily concentrated in the extremes of either party, but you know, it does not tend to reach most Americans. And so for us, rather than saying, you know, using that evidence to argue that AI definitely won't impact 2024, instead we say, what might be different about this moment that we're in? And so we sort of focus on three different ways that AI you know, might make misinformation impact or directly impact elections more. The first is that it could make it more pervasive. There could just be more of it. And there's this very sort of simple math, which, you know, misinformation needs to break into the mainstream. And if there's more of it, there's a higher probability that it does. The second is that it could make it more persuasive or more effective, that it could be better targeted. You know, there's reports in 2016 of the Macedonian troll farms. Their tweets were riddled with grammatical errors. And finally, we could have this moment where, you know, TikTok is this very different social media platform, which really sends content to users who haven't opted into a particular social network. It's not that I have to follow you, Mimi, to get your content, but instead it can just reach me. And so that might, you know, that dynamic of information diffusion might change, you know, the effect of who, or change who misinformation is reaching, and thus what the effect it has.
That was Zeev Sanderson, Executive Director of NYU Center for Social Media and Politics.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Next, a conversation about the Israel-Hamas war, the role of Iran's proxy forces, and concerns about a wider conflict in the Mideast, with Hudson Institute's Michael Duran and Benjamin Friedman of the group Defense Priorities.
Mr. Friedman, let's start with you. We've been at this war with Israel Hamas over 100 days. What's your assessment of it to date?
Well, obviously the Israelis set a pretty high bar for themselves in saying they're going to eliminate Hamas, and they haven't achieved that yet. And, you know, they suffered some of their worst casualties of the war the other day, and there's a larger problem from the United States perspective with escalation in Iraq and Syria, where U.S. forces that are stationed there are taking fire in the Red Sea, where the Houthis, in the name of defending Gaza, firing and shipping, and we're, along with the Brits and others, are firing at Yemen, where the Houthi government is. So, you know, there's a danger, I think, of escalation potentially even a war with Iran, which I think we should be eager to avoid. And it's, I think, high time that the United States pushed harder for a sort of ceasefire, but also a different policy in the Middle East that would limit our liabilities and look for the exits.
Mr. Duran, same question to you.
I think the Israeli war effort has gone steadily forward. It's been relatively successful, but it's a little bit stalled. In the last month or so, the progress has been harder to show. A lot of that has been because of American policy, because of what the kind of policies that that Ben just recommended, that the Israelis use less force and move to this new stage, what the Israelis are calling the third stage of the war, which is one of targeted strikes rather than full-spectrum military operations. We need, the United States, the U.S. interest is that Israel should win. Win, and that means defeating Hamas. Defeating Hamas means that it can no longer pose a threat to the citizens of Israel in the south, because the Israelis have to repopulate the south, which is now depopulated as a result of these attacks. With respect to Iran, we need to frame this conflict not as a conflict in Gaza, but as a conflict between the Iranian resistance axis, as the Iranians call it, and the American alliance system in the region. That's what it is. That's how the Iranians have openly, publicly defined it. That's how we need to understand it. We shouldn't weaken our ally in order to appease Iran and its allies.
What more should the U.S. be doing then, if that's the philosophy that you hold at this point?
We have to deter Iran and its proxies. Ben mentioned the risk of escalation. The Iranians have been escalating across the board in four or five different fronts, depending on how you want to count it. If we want de-escalation, we have to deter them.
Mr. Friedman, this idea of escalation, this idea of Iran and targeting that, so what's your thinking on that?
One, it's more complicated, I think, than Mike and others make it. That, you know, the Iranians have these proxies, yes, Houthis, Hezbollah, people, different groups in Iraq and Syria, but their degree of control over those groups is different. It's limited, I think, particularly in the case of the Houthis. They certainly give them weapons, but it's not at all clear to me that the Houthis are acting at the Iranians' behest in terms of what they're doing in the Red Sea, or that, you know, they would if Iran gave them orders. And I think there's a similar but more complex story about the people shooting at U.S. forces in Iraq and Syria. I'd say some of that is under the control of the Iranians, and some of it isn't. But I think the larger point is our interests in the Middle East, I think, would be badly harmed by a war with Iran. I think that's sort of the worst case scenario. You know, I think if we just bomb them, which I think is what Mike might advocate, it's almost certainly going to make things worse in terms of Iranian behavior, in terms of their desire to get nuclear weapons, in terms of their support for these proxy groups. So then you wind up in a situation where you sort of have to go whole hog if you want to get the, I don't know, deterrent effects that Mike's talking about, which is a full-on war. And I think that's an awful idea. So I think it's important to keep in mind our interests and Israel's diverge. They're not the same. And I think the United States has a very different interest in terms of Gaza. I think all the death and destruction there, which is largely intentional, is bad for the United States because we're bankrolling it. And I think the Israelis would like to see us sort of take on Iran and all its friends on their behalf, and we shouldn't do that.
Mr. Duran, this idea of bombing, and this, if that's the policy you're advocating for.
I'm advocating for deterring the Iranians. The Iranians are the ones who are carrying out a policy of bombing. They've attacked through their proxies, who are under the direct command and control of the Iranians. They have, in Iraq and Syria, They have attacked us about 130 times since October 7th. Some 80 times before that, from the beginning of the Biden administration. The United States has not attacked Iran once. It hasn't attacked an Iranian once. In Yemen, there's Abdulreza Shakhlai, who killed Americans in Iraq. He orchestrated the attack on Adel Al Jubeir, the Saudi ambassador here in Washington in 2011. He kills Americans, he orchestrates attacks on American soil. His job now is to provide the Houthis with ballistic missiles, drones, and cruise missiles. Why have we not targeted him? We have very, very carefully avoided attacking any Iranian while the Iranians have escalated against us all across the region.
I want to play you both a clip a couple days ago with John Kirby at the White House. He talked about this idea of escalation, particularly when it comes directly to Iran. It's a short clip, but I'll play it and get your thoughts on it.
If the Iranian government is concerned about escalation, then the best thing they could do would be to cut off the support that they give to groups like Hamas and Hezbollah and these Iran-backed militia groups in Iraq and Syria. We don't want to see the conflict escalate. We don't want to see some broader war. We're not looking for a war or a conflict with anybody. We're actually trying to de-escalate. And if the Iranians are serious about that and they want to de-escalate, well, we would welcome them stopping this support.
Not looking for a war, looking to de-escalate.
That's a very judicious statement, and it puts the emphasis where it should be, on the Iranian escalation that has gone on since October 7th.
Mr. Friedman.
I think the Iranians, they are responsible for giving money to Hamas. I don't think they were involved in planning the October 7th attacks, and they're responsible for funding Hezbollah and giving weapons to the Houthis. That's all true, but I think they're also operating through proxies because they want to avoid escalation. And right now we're in a sort of happy circumstance in a limited way where the U.S. government and the Iranian government want to avoid a full-on war. And I hope it stays that way. But again, you know, the United States has an interest in not getting pulled into a major war in the Middle East. And we have troops in Syria and Iraq who were there in the first place to defeat ISIS. We defeated ISIS a long time ago, and now they're sticking around kind of taking cover because they're taking fire all the time. It's not clear to me what U.S. interest or objective that serves other than just sort of picking a fight with Iran because we're mad at them. So I think, you know, we should, for starters, get U.S. forces out of those places. And if we want to have, you know, trouble with Iran, let's do it somewhere else out of range of rockets that their proxies possess.
There's reporting by Axios that it was last week that President Biden talked to the Israeli prime minister suggesting or at least urging a scale down of military operations in Gaza, saying, quote, you don't want to be in it for a year of war. Is it too little too late to make these kind of statements?
No, it's not too little too late. I mean, you know, there's 25,000 dead people in Gaza. And the United States, I think, has sort of attached itself ineffably to the war effort in Gaza by funding the Israelis. So, you know, the reputational harm and so forth is done. But, you know, a ceasefire or reduction in violence there would be welcome, would, you know, limit death and violence there. And I just think the objective of completely defeating Hamas, as laudable as it is, you know, I'd like to see there be no more Hamas, is not achievable within kind of reasonable timeframes or means, and, you know, sort of unrealistic. So it's time to sort of make some compromises with that organization, as noxious as it is.
Same question to you, sir.
I think my fundamental disagreement with Ben is that he I don't want to put words in his mouth, he'll respond, but as I understand the difference between us here, he seems to think that if the United States restrains itself, withdraws troops, pulls back further from the Middle East, that will stabilize the region and protect American interests. And that's not what will happen. It's a fundamental misreading of what's going on. As I said from the beginning, we shouldn't frame this as a war in Gaza. It's not a war in Gaza, objectively not. There's the Hezbollah from Lebanon is firing on Israel. The Houthis are firing on Israel and Americans and international shipping. Militias in Iraq and Syria are firing directly on Americans. This isn't a war for Gaza. This is a war of the Iranian alliance system against the American system. And what Ben is calling for will cede the Middle East to the Iranians, who have no compunction about attacking anybody with their missiles, drones, and ballistic missiles. That is the problem.
What do you think of that assessment?
Well, they're too weak a country to take over the Middle East. They're not a sort of a potential hegemon. And I think there's a natural balance of power in the Middle East that the United States doesn't have to manage among the major powers there, Israel, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Turkey. That will prevent there from being a major war or one country taking over and dominating the oil or something like that. So we have to think about what our interests are in the Middle East, not just sort of adopt this sort of managerial role. And even in that regard, look at the last 30 years of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, which have been animated by the idea that we can sort of manage its politics by, you know, doing regime change operations and keeping large contingents of forces there, overthrowing, you know, the Iraqi government. It's been a tragic, horrible mistake that has destabilized the region. So in general, I think our posture in the Middle East over the last few decades has been incredibly destabilizing. And I don't think everything's going to be honky-dory if the United States does less, but it'll be certainly be better for us and reduce our harms being inflicted on U.S. forces and serve U.S. interests better.
That was Benjamin Friedman, Policy Director at Defense Priorities, and Michael Duran, Director of the Center for Peace and Security in the Middle East at the Hudson Institute. Next, we take a deep dive into the bipartisan tax deal negotiated by lawmakers recently with Richard Rubin, who covers tax policy for The Wall Street Journal.
A bipartisan effort to give tax breaks to not only businesses, but certain families. How do we get to this point? How do we get to the point of this legislation being considered?
The core of this deal has actually been out there for more than a year, the idea that Democrats and Republicans could find a way there. And it stems from the things that each side wants. So for Republicans, there are three big business tax breaks that business tax provisions that changed over the course of 22-23, some affecting research deductions for businesses, some affecting capital expense deductions, like if you build a new factory or buy equipment. And then third is deductions for interest if you're borrowing and you're a company. And they want to make those go back to the way some of those things were before and make them a little more generous and easy to use for companies. Democrats have been wanting to enhance the child tax credit. Remember, we had the very large expanded child tax credit that was in place during 2021. It was fully refundable. So up, you know, $3,000 per household, $3,600 for young kids, didn't have to have any income to get it. Democrats want to go back there. There's an acknowledgement that they are not going to get all the way there. So the idea was Republicans would get the business tax breaks, Democrats would get something, but not the full 2021 version of the child tax credit. And they would have a meeting of minds and get there. And there were talks in late 2022, and then they resumed again in late 2023. And now finally here in early 2024, you've got the Republican chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Jason Smith, the Democratic chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, Ron Wyden. They've reached an agreement. The bill has moved through the House Ways and Means Committee already. And now we're waiting to see whether this Congress, which has had difficulty passing significant legislation, as we all know, can find a way to get this thing over the finish line.
As far as hurdles then they have to cross, what would those be?
So procedurally, it's, you know, they've got to get it through the House, and that may happen as soon as next week. Then they've got to get it through the Senate and then to the president. The White House has signaled its support for the bill as it's currently constituted. In terms of obstacles, there's a number of them out there. You've seen some Democrats, again, passed 40-3 in Ways and Means. There are three Democrats who voted against it who said that the child tax credit changes didn't go far enough. The bill is unbalanced and gives too much to business. So you may expect to see some of that on the House floor and in the Senate. I think you've also got some Republicans who've raised concerns about the child tax credit, who say it goes too far in the sense of providing benefits to people who in households where they're not working or not working a lot. And so there's concern about work incentives, and we can talk more about that. And then there's some concern about the big picture, because all this bill does is kind of set this up through 2025. So it goes retroactively and then forward for businesses through 2025. Same thing for the child tax credit, 23, 24, 25. And then what happens after that? And so it leaves all that open. But there's concerns, of course, that if you have tax breaks that are set to expire at the end of 2025, when we already have trillions of dollars of tax breaks that are scheduled to expire then, that there are deficit and other concerns about what will happen when the next Congress gets to that.
If you would, explain some things as far as these aspects of the legislation when it comes to the child credit. It would do, first of all, modify the calculation of the refundable credit.
Right. So right now, the credit is $2,000, and it increases as income goes up. You have to have at least $2,500 in earnings to qualify for the credit. So very, very low income families can't get it. That doesn't change at all in this. But currently, it phases in on a per child basis. So if you have two children, it takes you need more income to get to the full credit. If you get Now, under this proposal, you would be able to be phasing in for multiple children at one time. So it's a faster phase in if you have for multi-child family. The other thing that it does, it increases the maximum amount that's what we call refundable, so that you can get back even if you don't owe income taxes. Right now for 2023, I think that's 1,600 of the 2,000 you can get back. So if you have, if you qualify for the maximum credit, you can only get back 1,600 if you're not paying income taxes. This would gradually move that even faster toward the full 2,000. And then the third thing it does to the child tax credit is it indexes the $2,000 credit to inflation starting in 2025, where it's likely to be $2,100 for that year. If you recall, in 2017, Congress doubled the child tax credit as part of the tax law that President Trump signed, but they didn't set that $2,000 credit to index for inflation, as a lot of pieces of the tax code are. So it's an open question about what will happen to that. And so this kind of starts moving that credit upward, where it's been static and lost some of its value from 2017 to now.
On the business, well, before we go to the business, the child tax credit, exactly what is it? How does it work?
Right, so the child tax credit is up to $2,000 per child that you get on your tax credit. Remember, this is a credit, not a deduction, so it reduces your tax bill, doesn't reduce the amount of income you're reporting. So it's a $2,000 credit is more valuable than a $2,000 deduction. The idea of it is really to provide a benefit to households who are raising children as a recognition of the cost of raising children. So it's a pretty broadly supported benefit. It goes up pretty relatively far up the income scale. You can get the full credit if you're an individual with income of $200,000 or a married couple with up to $400,000. After that, it phases out. And so it is a broadly enjoyed benefit that has had bipartisan support over the years. Democrats, I think, want to make it more of like a universal child allowance concept, where everybody, you get it no matter what. They had, you know, their monthly payments in 2021. They like that structure where you're, you know, providing income support to families to reduce child poverty over the course of the year, as opposed to these sort of lump sum payments that people get as part of their tax refund. But that's the basic idea of the child tax credit.
That was Richard Rubin, tax policy reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website at cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern Time.